This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. September 13th marked the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Violence Against Women Act. That law established the National Domestic Violence Hotline, the Department of Justice's Office on Violence Against Women, and a number of training programs on gender-based violence for victim advocates, law enforcement, and the judiciary. The law's five-year reauthorization was passed in the House, but sits stalled in the Senate over Republican objections. The obstruction is untimely. Researchers at Northeastern University have found that after almost four decades of steady decline, intimate partner homicides increased each year between 2014 and 2017. Though reauthorization got a shout-out from Joe Biden in Thursday's Democratic presidential debate,
25th anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act is up. The Republican Congress has not reauthorized it. Let's put pressure on them to pass the Violence Against Women Act now.
The legislative roadblock has not commanded much attention from the media or the public, which may have something to do with the words we use, words which do not convey the horror.
Anytime you put the word domestic in front of anything, domestic terrorism versus international terrorism, it has a softening to it.
Rachel Louise Snyder has covered domestic violence in the United States for 10 years and is the author of No Visible Bruises.
Of course, domestic violence replaced battered women, which had its own problems, but at least that created a sense of what was going on.
She prefers the term intimate terrorism.
Because I think it comes closer to getting at the psychology of what it's like to live within a situation of domestic violence. It feels like terror, the anticipation of physical violence. There's a reason that neurologists today compare the brain scans of domestic violence victims with the brain scans of prisoners of war. There's something about living in the stress of that situation. And I think intimate terrorism captures all those different constellations.
Let's now address the news. This week is the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Violence Against Women's Act. Why hasn't it been reauthorized, as it routinely was four previous times?
The bill was intended, it was written to be evaluated every 5 years. And as we learned more and as our research evolved and our programs and practices, we could have some sense of being able to move grant monies around or have further protections. For example, in 2013, you saw more protections for immigrants and Native American women and LGBTQ communities. And so in the 2018 bill, there was a tightening of gun restrictions federally for convicted abusers, and the NRA came out against that. And that's essentially what is holding it up.
You wrote in your book that the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson was a turning point in the evolution of this law.
The OJ case really brought to the forefront the idea that domestic violence homicide and domestic violence could happen to anyone. You know, when we heard Nicole Brown Simpson's 911 tapes, the general public could hear how terrifying that kind of situation is. People said if it can happen to someone who's beautiful and wealthy and famous, then it really can happen to anybody. At the same time, communities of color said, wait a minute, why did it take a rich, beautiful white woman to bring this to our attention? We've been saying this for years. So her case, I think, spurred a lot of things. But even prior to her case happening, the Violence Against Women Act had been tussled about in Congress for years. And it was a really hard fought win for Joe Biden and the people who wrote the bill. I mean, it really took years for that to pass. So I think those two things kind of happened hand in hand.
I want to talk about the soft peddling of domestic violence, not just by the cops, but by the media as well. You know, I'm thinking of the coverage of murder suicides, a term which seems often to be kind of perfunctory and even dismissive.
I would like to give a class to everybody who writes headlines in this country and beseech them to leave out the term domestic dispute.
Preliminarily, this appears to be a domestic dispute. It did not involve any members of the public.
Thank you. And breaking this morning, Omaha police say someone is cut when strangers intervene in a couple's argument at a gas station.
Linebacker Reuben Foster just released by the San Francisco 49ers after an arrest on domestic violence charges has quickly found a new team, the Washington Redskins.
What's really happening is that it compartmentalizes it in the minds of readers and even in the minds of reporters. And it even goes beyond just headlines. I read a story just yesterday where a grandmother and one of her grandchildren were killed, or maybe more than one, but a four-year-old survived. And the article said, you know, four-year-old was unharmed. And it's really disturbing to think that we can't take one second out to say this child was physically unharmed in this one single event. But that child is going to have a lifetime of trauma to deal with. And also, we need to deal with that child, too, to make sure that child doesn't become a future victim or a future abuser.
Which the odds suggest is a very likely outcome.
That's right. So I think that what it does is it enables our inaction.
You write in your book about so many other myths and assumptions and just fundamental misunderstandings of what takes place inside the home, or actually outside the home in many cases as well, when men stalk the women who they're about to harm. But a question we've all heard and maybe even asked ourselves is, why didn't she just leave?
Said, why did she stay? Why didn't she leave?
Right. And that is the issue at hand. Why didn't she leave? Whether it was money, whether it was, you know, she was mentally abused by him and she couldn't leave him. That's the real issue we should be talking about, but nobody
We is. Expect leaving to have a visual of going on a trip. You pack your bag, you're out the door. But it doesn't happen like that. It happens in stages. So for a victim who is really controlled in every way, which is not uncommon, they can't just walk out their door. They're monitored, right? And if you have kids, you can't just take your kids out of school and register them in another school without the permission of both spouses. You can't just quit your job if the only shelter bed available is 4 hours away across your state. So there's a really careful calculation that happens. And in my book, I talk about a woman named Michelle who lived in a home that they rented from her father, she and her husband, Rocky. And she had done things like secretly put the house in her name. Her father had done that because he knew that it was an abusive situation. So she was laying the groundwork to be able to leave. She wasn't allowed to work, but she was allowed to take classes. So she had a plan to get her nursing degree in 2 years, at which point she was going to hopefully be able to convince her husband, Rocky, that she could have a job outside the home. But she was doing all of these things because her view, and this is the view of so many victims, was incredibly long. So it's not that she wasn't leaving. It's that leaving safely was going to be a long-term process because leaving is the most dangerous time. So many women are killed when they leave. This is when victims die, when their abuser feels like they're losing control.
Another misassumption that you've pointed out is that we'll all be able to recognize someone who's violent, you know, because they're all brutes flying into rages at the drop of a hat. But that's not so either, is it?
Not so. Not so. The first time I walked into a batterers intervention group was outside of Boston. There were seven men. And some of them were wearing construction kind of gear, like they had just got off work. Two of them were in suits and ties. One of them was an undergraduate college student. I mean, all of them were guys I'd have gone out for a beer with. They were funny. They were joking around. They were laughing. And it, I got to tell you, it shook me. It really shook me because I realized in that moment, there's nothing. There's no placard that they carry around that says, you know, I'm an abuser. What we're thinking about is a rageaholic. And what we're doing is thinking anger management. And that is not the same as abuse. Only 20 or 25% of abusers fit that profile of rageaholic.
And the rest are what? I mean, gaslighters, passive aggressive, what?
Yeah, they tend to be very narcissistic. They tend to be very manipulative. But that charm is what initially draws people to them. And so it's not surprising to me at all when I read something like Eric Schneiderman, the former attorney general for New York, because by all accounts, he was charming. He was also narcissistic. He was also manipulative.
Ally of the Me Too movement is resigning as New York State Attorney General because of allegations that he physically and emotionally abused four romantic partners.
It doesn't surprise me when people who are at the top of their game professionally turn out to be abusers, and some of the most vindictive abusers.
Back to politics and pathology for a moment. You mentioned that one of the political obstacles to reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act is pushback by the NRA. The thing is, as you have written, we cannot discuss the epidemic of American domestic violence without thinking about guns. Not just the correlation between gun availability and murder of an intimate, but the relationship between domestic violence and mass shootings.
It's disturbing to me that more isn't made of this. We really forget that a lot of the mass shootings that are infamous are, in fact, domestic violence homicide. Those are things like Adam Lanza in Sandy Hook began his rampage with his mother, right, which was a domestic violence homicide. Or even going way back to what is widely considered the first mass shooting in this country with Charles Whitman at the University of Texas tower shooting. He started the night before by killing his wife and his mother. So we don't think about those. But the second corollary to mass shootings and domestic violence is that even some mass shootings that are not domestic violence homicides, these shooters have domestic violence in their backgrounds. And I'm talking here about people like Dylan Roof, who witnessed, by some accounts, terrible abuse between his father and stepmother. And there's discussion or allegations that he was terribly abused as a child himself. Or Omar Mateen, who did the Orlando Pulse shooting, had strangled his first wife in the state of Florida, which is a felony, and if charged, carries a 10-year sentence. But he was never charged with strangulation. So there's two different ways of looking at the connection between domestic violence and mass shootings.
But if you're right, we should see that there is less domestic violence in societies that don't have guns absolutely at hand everywhere.
There's a researcher at Michigan State, April Zioli, who looked at whether or not if guns are taken away, will people use other means, right? This is one of the common arguments by members of the NRA and gun rights activists that if you take the guns, they'll just use knives or they'll use strangulation or some other method. And in fact, she found that to be absolutely not true. Like nothing, no research really backs that theory. There's another book that was written by a man named David Adams, and he interviewed 14 men who had killed their wives with guns. And 11 of the 14 told him that had guns not been so readily available, had they not been able to get a gun so easily, they don't believe they would have killed their spouse.
Maybe the most fundamental failure of understanding you have written is the relationship between domestic violence and not just guns, but virtually everything that ails the society. How so?
It's really staggering when you begin to think about the ways in which domestic violence intersects really so many of the pressing social issues that we face today. I mean, everything here from mass incarceration to homelessness. More than half the women who are homeless in this country are homeless as a direct result of domestic violence. 80% of the men who are incarcerated today were either child witnesses or victims of abuse when they were growing up. I've read statistics, although there are no national statistics on this, that more than half the women in prison today are there because they killed their abusers out of self-defense. Being evicted from one's apartment is often a result of domestic violence. So it really intersects so many of the major things that we are facing as a society. And it gets to why the Violence Against Women Act is so important, because that act repositioned domestic violence. And it told the victims of this country that we see you and we care about you. And to take that away, well, I think we know what the message is going to be.
What are the prospects for the act? Is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell going to keep this from coming to the floor? Will his deference to the NRA keep this from being restored to its place in the law of the land?
Why he won't bring this to a vote, this seems like an issue that should be completely bipartisan. And it's in terms of the federal budget, it's a drop in the bucket. It's $500 million. It's nothing.
In the budget of a department that has $28 billion.
That's right. And I talked to a woman just today, and I asked her, how much federal funding do you get? She said 25% of our funding just for our domestic homicide reduction comes from the federal VAWA grants. 25%. And that's for homicide reduction. That doesn't count the federal funding they get for shelters and to house and other advocacy, court representatives and things like that, free legal services. So people will die. If we don't reauthorize VAWA, people will die. That is the long and short of it. It's a two-part problem. The practical reality is that people will die. The other part is this message that we are going to give to victims all over this country, that your safety is not a priority in this country. And I have to say, it underscores a message of misogyny that we're already getting these days.
Rachel, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Louise Snyder is the author of No Visible Bruises.
Coming up, there are three statues of a lady in New York Harbor. Which one you see depends on how you look.
This is On the Media.